We've been talking about Acts 2:42. There were about 3,000 people who became Christians on the day of Pentecost, and after they became Christians, you have them continuing steadfastly in various activities. Anybody remember what the word steadfastly means?
Persistent.
Persistent, very good. That stubborn persistence. We will not let it go. We're going to really insist on doing these kinds of things, this kind of activity. And we talked about their stubbornness, their commitment to, as you look at verse 42, the apostles' doctrine, the teaching, fellowship. We discussed that last time. Today we want to talk about the breaking of bread. In the Greek text, you have two definite articles. You have the breaking of the bread. That's important. If you look down a little bit, you'll also see a reference to food in Acts 2, verse 46. There it says, and day by day, continuing steadfastly with one accord in the temple and breaking bread at home. You don't have the same kind of construction there. So several people, including me, believe that in Acts 2, verse 46, you have what might be referred to as a common meal. Potluck meal, group meal, shared meal. They were eating together in that sense. But back here in Acts 2, verse 42, I believe that the communion is under discussion, the breaking of the bread. So you have that conclusion supported, I think, not only by the definite articles, but you also have some other activities that you would associate with worship. For example, you've got the teaching that's done, you've got the prayers, and fellowship would certainly be involved with coming together for assemblies. One fellow asked this question. Sometimes people say, well, we just don't think that we're dealing with the Lord's Supper in Acts 2, verse 42. And he said, if that's not correct, is it not remarkable that Christians should be steadfast in eating food to sustain the body? I think that's a great question. Christians should be Christians were steadfast in eating food to sustain the body. Then he went on to say, this they did before they became Christians. So there is nothing distinctively Christian about continuing steadfastly in eating one's meals. Acts 2:41 shows these people had put on Christ. Acts 2:42 tells us that they continued steadfastly in the teaching after putting on the Lord. And again, Acts 2:46, you've got their common meal. So I've got, as I look at this text, I look at it from the standpoint of the Lord's Supper, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Now, if you are in a congregation very long, or you're a Christian for very long, you're probably going to find some people who at some point are not satisfied with something about the Lord's Supper. Maybe it's not passed in a way that they want, or whatever it might be. Taste may not be quite what they want. The grape juice is a little this, a little that. In the 4th century, there were some people, I would not count them as faithful Christians, but there were some people who were known as the Ophites, and that comes from the Greek word for snake. And their practice, you're going back about 1,600 years, so that's a long time to know exactly what they were doing, but their practice was to let at least one snake and multiple snakes crawl over the bread of the Lord's Supper. There's some other sources which suggest that they also crawled through the fruit of the vine. And then that was served. The priest, and of course, when you think about the New Testament church, every Christian is a priest, so that's why I say I wouldn't count them as faithful brethren, but by that time they had special priests. The priest would then break the bread, and there are some sources which indicate that the priest actually kissed the snake. There are some other sources which indicate that all the worshipers kissed the snake. And then depending on which version of it, the snake was either put back in its container till next time or the snake was killed, depending on which version. So if you ever have some complaints about the Lord's Supper, you might think back to the Ophites about 1,600 years ago and be glad that you were not part of that group. But I tell you that to let you know that people have had a lot of different ideas about the Lord's Supper over the years. Some of them have really been out there like the Ophites. Some of them have not been nearly as bizarre. So when this topic comes up, people do have some different ideas, and that's certainly true here. When we think about some of the modern ideas, as far as questions that people ask or some things that differ from the Bible, one of the items that comes up would be frequency. You've probably talked with someone who has claimed the Bible doesn't say how often we are to have the Lord's Supper. So the frequency is up to us, and people sometimes say we want to have it once a year, twice a year, to make it sort of holy, to make it special. Other people would perhaps argue that it's not that convenient, so let's make it quarterly, let's make it monthly, and then of course you have some congregations like ours which have it on a weekly basis, on a regular basis. But people sometimes do claim that we don't have any way to tell how often we should partake of it, and they will sometimes buttress that claim by saying if you have it weekly, then what's the objection sometimes is tossed out?
Does it mean as much?
It's not going to mean as much, it's going to be common. And we should reserve it for once or twice a year, maybe once a quarter. So it's going to be in the special category. Well, let's think through that. I can give you the passages if you'd like to take a look at them, but when you start looking at the Bible, you look at the Old Testament. What do you find as far as the level of regulation when it comes to the feasts? Did God just say, we'll have a feast on some day? All right, when you start looking through the Old Testament and you start reading through the rules, it's laborious. God said, this is going to be the day, this is going to be the time, this is going to be the season, this is what you do, this is how this offering is to proceed, this is who's going to do it, this is what you don't do. I mean, it is literally step by step. I don't know about you, but when I open up a box, I just don't have the engineer mind that Teresa and some others do, and I see a set of instructions that are about 52 steps long, I kind of groan, think, oh boy, that is just not anything that's going to make my day. But there's some people who really like that. They like to go through all 52 steps. And if you had been under the Old Testament system, you would have had to go through, you would have had to follow all those steps, a very sequential system. So when somebody comes along and says, well, I just don't believe that under the New Testament we have information about the frequency given, here's really what they're saying. Now, they'd never probably admit this, but you're saying that that Old Testament, which involved what kind of blood? Animal blood. The Old Testament, which involved animal blood, was legislated down to the most minute detail. Now we have what kind of covenant according to the book of Hebrews? We have a better covenant. That's the key word in the book of Hebrews. And the better covenant is based not on animal blood. It's based on the blood of Jesus Christ, who is the Son of God. And with this better covenant, based on the blood of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, people sometimes say what concerning things like the regulation?
Just do what you want.
If you substituted steak and potatoes and orange juice or Pepsi, some, I've actually had some people say, well, that would be perfectly fine. So you believe that the better covenant, the superior covenant, lacks what the Old Testament, the inferior covenant, had. Don?
Well, correct me if I'm misreading it, but in the Old Testament, when God crossed every T and dotted every I, that pertained to a certain level of people, right? The priest. Not the people, not the average person.
Well, if you're going to make a sacrifice, you couldn't just make that sacrifice whenever you wanted.
Right, I know.
Okay.
I know, but the people did not actually participate in that sacrifice. They may have shown up, and they couldn't have come from the outlying villages in for every time they had a sacrifice. So it's basically it was a priest that did this.
The priest was going to be sort of the centerpiece, the focus,
yeah,
of Old Testament worship.
In the New Testament, in the Lord's Supper, individually, mm-hmm, we take part of that sacrifice.
Correct.
So there's a big difference to me in that, as far as dictating exactly how it should go and in the New Testament.
Okay.
I'm not arguing against...
But you're exactly right as far as now it's been expanded. Before, the weight was on the priest and the high priest. I mean, they were carrying a pretty heavy load. I mean, this is your job to make it right, especially for the high priest, going in once a year for the Day of Atonement. And I'm sure there was some shaking, some fear and trembling. It's my job to go in there, and it's my job to get out. And you have some reports, as far as historical data, which says the people outside were praying that the guy would come out. Well, you would want that, because what's he doing on your behalf? He's going in for the sins of the nation. And if he doesn't come back out, you're thinking what? Yeah, and whose head was on the block? Not only his, but mine too. So, yes, and now it's individualized, if you will. Each Christian, 1 Peter chapter 2, 5, and 9, would be classified as a priest. Stan?
Well, you just mentioned the fact that we're all priests now, so that might enter into the discussion also.
Yeah, it may. I want to show you this. As I said, we could go through a lot of rules and regulations as far as the different feasts and the Day of Pentecost and so forth, but let's take a look back in the book of Ezekiel for a second. Might not be something that you expect from Ezekiel chapter 45, verses 21 through 25.
45, you say?
Uh-huh. Ezekiel 45. These will be the last few verses. 45, starting with 21. In the first month, in the 14th day of the month, he shall have the Passover. Well, that's kind of an odd statement, isn't it? We'd expect the Passover back there, Exodus, Leviticus, those kinds of books. You shall have the Passover, a feast of 7 days, and leavened bread shall be eaten. And upon that day shall the prince prepare for himself and for all the people of the land a bullock for a sin offering. And the 7 days of the feast he shall prepare a burnt offering to Jehovah, 7 bullocks and 7 rams without blemish daily the 7 days, and a he-goat daily for a sin offering. And he shall prepare a meal offering, an ephah for a bullock, and an ephah for a ram, and a hin of oil to an ephah. In the 7th month, in the 15th day of the month, in the feast, shall he do the like the 7 days, according to the sin offering, according to the burnt offering, and according to the meal offering, and according to the oil. Now, that's not going to be a lot different than what you find in the earlier sections of the Old Testament. I read that to point out the fact that even in the prophetical writings, you've got information about the Old Testament offerings. So when somebody comes along and says, well, look, the Old Testament was carefully legislated, yes, it was. When you've got that even in the book of Ezekiel, it's kind of like, wow, God made it very, very clear that there are some rules. And then you want me to believe that when it comes to the New Testament, we're dealing not with animal blood, but with the Son of God, that God has left off information when it comes to the elements. He's left off information about the frequency and so forth. That just makes no sense at all. So you would then, at that point, begin looking to the New Testament and ask the question, do we not find some information about frequency? Do we not find some information about what we're to use? Do we not find some information as far as what day we're supposed to use? And you have to start searching that stuff out. Now, if it doesn't exist, and that's a possibility, then you would say God has not legislated that. But you would certainly want to diligently search the New Testament, because logically that would make sense, that you would have some information there. And how you would find that information, or the form that you would find that information, may not always be what people think they need to have or want to have, or what God has provided. But still, that's something that you would need to search for, and something that we will look at today. A couple of the quick points that I want to make here. When you think about steadfastly in Acts 2:42, what did we say concerning that word? It describes people who are stubborn, people who are persistent. Where do we see that? People who persist in something today, people who are stubborn about something. What's one of the first things that comes to the mind?
Sports.
Well, okay. If a game is on TV, they're not going to miss the...
Oh, okay.
All right, that would be one. That wasn't quite the direction I wanted to go, but it's a good answer. Let's see if we can... He doesn't miss what? He never misses... Well, okay, that could be one. And there have been some people whose lives have been saved. You've got the farmer out there in the field, never misses worship, doesn't show up on a Wednesday night, somebody's concerned about him, they go out and the tractor has turned over on him. And because he's habitual in his attendance, they find him and save his life. So there's actually been a couple cases of that. But there's even one that would probably be a better answer than that. He never misses work. Haven't we ever met some people like that? They might not be feeling well, but they've got a perfect attendance record, maybe for the last year, the last 5 years, 20 years, whatever it might be. Here's a person who always shows up. If you have Christians who are persisting in, they're stubborn in observing the breaking of the bread. Does that sound like once a year? No. Sound like twice a year? Probably not. I mean, because the church has just been established, hasn't it? So if you are persisting in the breaking of bread, it can't be once a year, can't be twice a year. Doesn't even sound like once a quarter or once a month. It sounds like
often.
Now, would that be daily? That would be a question to ask. Was this going to be once or twice a week? We don't know based on Acts 2, verse 42. But it does sound like this was something that was being done on a regular basis. Now, we've heard over the years Acts 20, verse 7 read. Paul, Troas is under consideration. Anybody remember what Acts 20, verse 7 says?
They come together and break bread.
All right. On the first day of the week. That doesn't say the first day of the year, that was a Sunday, or the first day of the month. When the first day of the week comes, what happens? Christians are going to assemble. That sounds a little bit like Acts chapter 2, verse 42. Persistent, stubborn, when that day of the week comes that Jesus was raised from the dead on, Sunday. First day of the week comes, and what do? They assemble to break bread, to have the Lord's Supper. So that's probably not a complete answer for us, but when you line that up with Acts 2, verse 42, the steadfastness, the persistence here, the coming together on the first day of the week. Then let's take a look at a couple of the passages, and this shouldn't be new information for us, but we'll review it anyway. 1 Corinthians 16, You have information about the great collection in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 1. And then in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 2, some translations will use the word every there. That's supported by the Greek text. But some of the older versions, like the King James and ASV, don't have it. But he says, upon the what? First day of the week. Anybody in class have the word every in 1 Corinthians 16, 2, depending on their version? Upon, okay, at least one does. Upon the okay, at least two do. Upon the first day of every week. Well, when's the first day of the week? Well, let's think it through. How many days in the week are there?
Seven.
What was the seventh day for the Jew? Sabbath slash Saturday. All right, again, how many days in the week are there? Seven. What's the seventh day? Saturday. So you get to the seventh day, Saturday, and then you have to start over again. So what's the first day of the week? It's going to be Sunday. So when you see the first day of the week in the Bible, it's another way of describing Sunday. So you have the Corinthians coming together when? Upon the first day of the week, every Sunday. So that's when they're assembling. Now, they may have had some other times, that seems likely, but this is the time that is associated with worship. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians 11 for a second and see what we find in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 20. Every Sunday assembly, 1 Corinthians 16, 2. 1 Corinthians 11, 20 says, when therefore ye
meet together,
when you assemble together, when were they assembling? 1 Corinthians 16, 2. They were assembling on every Sunday. Okay, so we're sort of going through the letter backwards a little bit. And Paul goes on to say something else. He says, when you come together, it is not possible to do what? To eat the Lord's Supper. Now, was it not possible to eat the Lord's Supper because they were leaving the communion elements at home? No. They brought the elements, but what were they doing? They were mixing some food. They were mixing the kinds of table meals that we find in Acts 2, verse 46, with the information associated with the Lord's Supper and the elements for the Lord's Supper. But Paul taught them to meet, 1 Corinthians 16, 2, every Sunday. They were in the habit, when they came together to meet, to have the elements for the Lord's Supper. They weren't using those elements correctly, but they had those elements. And then if you back up a little bit more, 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 17. Paul said, I sent unto Timothy. He's my beloved and faithful child in the Lord. He's going to put you in remembrance of my ways which are in Christ. My ways which are in Christ. And then at the end of 1 Corinthians 4:17, he says, even as I teach where? Everywhere, in every church. Question, if Paul taught that Christians come together on which Sunday? Every Sunday, 1 Corinthians 16, 2. What do you think he taught everybody else? Meet on Sunday, the first day of the week, every Sunday. If Paul taught the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, bring the elements for the Lord's Supper together. When you come together, what do you think he taught everywhere else? The same thing. What do you see in Acts 20, verse 7, a different setting? When the first day of the week came, what happened? There was an assembly, and they had some preaching, they had some teaching, they had the Lord's Supper. Acts 2:42, what do you find? They continued steadfastly in the breaking of the bread. Now, we could also point to a couple other things. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul uses the present tense to describe the partaking of the Lord's Supper. Present tense means ongoing activity. Now, you may not know just from that how often the activity took place, but still, it is persistent activity which reinforces which we have thus talked about. So, you have several lines of reasoning there to show that the Lord's Supper was observed by Christians on the first day of the week. Don?
Back in 1 Corinthians 11.
Okay.
And Paul says, in the same way, he took the cup after supper.
Mm-hmm.
So they were meeting for a meal.
Mm-hmm.
And the elements, the wine and the bread, was present at every meal.
Okay, now, when you say they, are you talking about the Corinthians or Christ and the disciples?
No, Corinthians.
Oh, okay.
Because that's who he's chiding right here.
Yes.
I'm not doing it right. Reading before people come together and all that kind of stuff. And then observing the Lord's Supper, during supper. Because even Christ did it.
Yes.
Before and after supper.
Yes. when you look at Corinth, it's kind of like one side of a telephone conversation. You can only determine so much. But not everybody agrees, but I'm of the persuasion that, let's take your thought. I'm going to come back to that. I think you're exactly right. But let's take a look at the book of Jude. I mentioned this not too long ago. I think this was in the class on fellowship. Let's see how some translations render verse 12. Here's the ASV. These are they who are bidden or hidden rocks in your love feasts when they feast with you.
What verse?
Jude, verse 12. ASV. These are people, false teachers Jude was talking about. He says they're secretive. They're like hidden rocks. You know, a ship doesn't want to, you've got a rock just underneath the water. The ship hits it and the ship sinks. There was a barge not too long ago, or a big bunch of people that got injured because ship hit the water, hit water with rocks in it. So here Jude talks about they're feasting with you. They were coming together. They were eating. And he refers to it as a love feast. Anybody have something substantially different than that in Jude 12? What do you have? Okay, love feast, charity feast. King James has the word charity for love. That was an older way of describing it. So charitable feast, anything else that's much different? All right, so when you look at Jude, you do have an admission that there were feasts. There were some kind of love feast. Peter talks about the same kind of thing. Now, what were all the details about the love feast? I don't know. But if these were the same kind of thing that was going on at Corinth, which Don suggested, and I'm of that persuasion as well. I can't prove it 100%, but it seems to be that they were coming together, just as we would have a potluck today. That was part of the assembly. And they also had the Lord's Supper. And maybe trying to draw from what Jesus and the disciples did there, they've got all the meal together, and they didn't separate it. I have heard reports of congregations doing a similar kind of thing today. I've not seen it. I can't prove that it's been done. But I have heard that in at least a couple places in the U.S., a congregation comes and they take the Lord's Supper, and that is also, at least in some respects, made part of that common meal. Now, there might be a small distinction there. We're going to have the Lord's Supper now. But even that, again, we've talked about the fact before that even if all things are lawful, not all things are expedient. So when you start mixing table food, potluck food, the fried chicken with the elements of the Lord's Supper, you are in very gray waters at best. And that seems like what the Corinthians had done. They got kind of wild with the food. And Paul says, look, that's why it's not possible. Discern. You know, you're not examining yourselves. It's all just one big meal. And maybe part of that was because the Corinthians, Paul said, you're not waiting for one another. And it was, let's get the potluck food in there, let's eat it, let's throw in the Lord's Supper. And then people came and they had been overlooked. So it's sort of a one-sided conversation. We don't know all that was going on. And it's a little difficult to be completely definitive about that. But I lean towards that particular view. Ray and then Betty.
I do know the congregation in California that some of the members would not take the Lord's Supper in the assembly. They would wait to do it at home. And they would have the meal at home, like we're talking about, and have the Lord's Supper there. During that meal, that was their Lord's Supper. We supported the preacher there for a while until we found out what was going on. Then we stopped supporting them at that point. We just didn't feel that what they were teaching was right.
So they wouldn't have the Lord's Supper as a corporate body?
Part of it did.
Huh.
There were certain members and the preacher that did not.
Huh. As I say, you get all kinds of interesting things brought to your attention when you start talking about the Lord's Supper. So it's intriguing to hear about some of the things that people have done and continue to do. So that's
also why it separated, caused another congregation to kind of split over that same
thing. Yeah. The Lord's Supper is designed to bring people together, not to keep people apart. So on that count, you would probably have some issues that you'd really want to take a look at. Betty?
I've got a couple of different versions here. One of them says that they were doing it without fear. The other one says they were doing it without reverence.
Okay. Yeah, I think the fear there would be in this respect of respect, reverence, yes, fear of God and so forth. And that's really what it was. And Paul says, look, you know, we've talked about the fact that before that God is, you know, with you. Remember Jesus when he gave the Lord's Supper, you know, I'll be in your midst. You know, he's there with us as the worship takes place and so forth. So it wasn't a good thing. Jeff?
Well, the King James says when they had supped. So what's the original Greek text say for that word? And how do we know that that was not referring back to the bread?
Okay, where are we looking at as far as the passage?
Well, we're in 1 Corinthians.
Okay.
Talk about getting, taking the bread, and then it said after the same manner also he took the cup when he had supped, then it goes into the fruit of the vine. You're saying that that's a common meaning.
Okay, remember, okay, let's take a look at Luke's account. Luke 22, maybe? Okay, Luke 22, let's start with verse 14. And when the hour was come, he sat down and the apostles with him. So you've got everybody coming together. And he said unto them, with desire I have desired to eat what? Not the Lord's Supper. He said, I've desired to eat the Passover. The Passover had been that meal that had been in existence for a long, long time, thousands of years. He said, I want to eat the Passover with you before I suffer. For I say unto you, I shall not eat it until it be fulfilled in the kingdom of God. He receives a cup, he gives thanks. Take this, divide it among yourselves. I shall not drink henceforth of this fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God shall come. Took bread, break it. This is my body, which is for you. And then you have in verse 20, and the cup in like manner after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, but behold. So you've got two different cups there. Sometimes people will mix those cups up as far as they'll identify the wrong cup for the Lord's Supper. But you've got the Lord's Supper being instituted in conjunction with the Passover meal. And that was one of the points I was trying to make, and maybe didn't do it too well as far as what Don was saying. When the Lord's Supper was instituted, you've got that taking place in the midst of a meal, the Passover meal. And I think that's what Paul's trying to say in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. After that meal had been completed, then Jesus instituted what we now refer to as the Lord's Supper.
So you're not saying in between the bread and the fruit of the vine?
I'm not saying what?
You're not saying the supper was in between the bread and the fruit of the
vine? I don't think so. Again, with the information that we have, it's a little bit difficult to be definitive, but I think that you, especially from Luke's account, I'm strongly inclined to think that it had been finished, and then this comes up as a separate matter. And maybe the Corinthians tried to go back to that and pull from that. And it all kind of got muddled together, and Paul offers a very strong rebuke. But in our day and time, because of how we're set up in this culture, if you're going to have a meal in the building, it seems to me to be a whole lot cleaner to worship and eat, or to eat and worship, and to make sure that we've got a clear distinction between those two things so we avoid the kinds of problems that you sometimes find Ray mentioned one illustration of that, and you also avoid the kinds of problems that we have in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And that seems to be Paul's consensus as well, because he says, if you're hungry, what? Eat at home. In other words, if you can't control yourself, then make this distinction. And wisdom, I think, would dictate for us that's the way that we approach it today. So we can come back to you after we'll take Don's thought.
Well, I'm looking at the Lord's Supper in Luke. And the first cup he took was not that this is my blood. The covenant he just said, I won't drink it again until...
Correct.
Okay. The second, then he took the bread before supper and broke it. And then after supper, he took the cup and said, this is my cup, this is the blood of the new covenant. So if you were, you know, if you were pure and the word, if this is what Jesus said, apparently, you know, it is.
Yeah, and that's why there were, if you look at the Jews, it looks like they had three or four cups. So trying to get the three or four cups in there, maybe not all the cups were recorded, because that really wouldn't be relevant to the Lord's Supper. So we've got quite a few details, I think sufficient details to make a clear demarcation between the two, which we need to do today. But I do strongly lean, as I mentioned to Jeff, I do strongly lean towards the idea that it had been finished as far as a Passover meal. Now we're moving to something else.
But it doesn't say that here, Brad. I mean, are
you... Well, it doesn't say after supper?
In the same way, he took the cup.
Yes.
After they had eaten.
Yes, and that's what I'm saying. After they'd eaten, after supper. Well, unless that bread was part of the Jewish Passover feast. So, and that's why I say you've only got so many details there. So you can take that and work with it in the best way you can. that is the so position.
If you did, like Ray was talking about the brethren in California,
yeah,
that it would become not the occasion that it should be.
Right.
And it becomes routine. As we take the Lord's Supper every Sunday, and it becomes routine for some people.
Well, but the problem there, if you use that as an argument against every Sunday communion, you have two issues. Number one, what's God said?
I'm not arguing against it, though.
Oh, okay, I know. But I'm just, right, that was the other point I wanted to develop. If, you know, people make arguments of, you know, for example, if we don't have instrumental music, people are not going to come. Well, how weighty is that? Let's say that nobody comes if you have instrumental music.
You don't.
Yeah. Or if you lack instrumental music, nobody's going to come. All right. How much weight would you attach to that argument?
None.
It doesn't matter. Why? All right. If God says this, it doesn't matter if everybody in the world says do the opposite. So when somebody comes along and says, well, you know, we don't want to do it because of this, that, and the other thing. First question is, what does the Bible say? What do the scriptures tell us? But let's look at it from the practical side as well. Somebody says, well, the communion is going to be more common. How many people think they pray just about every day the last week? All right, well, at least I think several in the class. Did it become too common? You know, you've had 7 or 8 days of prayer or maybe 6 months of prayer. You think, I'm going to take a week off because it becomes too common? Why is it that the Lord's Supper is put into that category, it's going to become too common, but no other aspect of it? What about giving? Weekly giving, it's going to be too common. I'm just going to give once a year. Or singing. I'm going to save it up, and I'm going to sing really well when Easter comes or Christmas comes. We know that's not right. And yet people sometimes apply that reasoning. I hesitate to use the word logic, but they apply that reasoning to that. All right, Carol?
I think it comes down to people do what they want. They either want to obey God or they want to argue about everything. And so you just can't spend your whole life worrying about what everybody's going to do. You just have to do what you should.
Yes. I'm going to take that and lead into the next point. We'll see if we need to back up a little bit. But you have here, I think, the issue which comes up from time to time, and people say, well, where does the Bible specifically tell me to do this? Or where does the Bible specifically tell me not to do that? We discussed this briefly a couple weeks ago. Not every passage or not every section of the Bible is going to cover every specific thing. Where in the Bible does it say, thou shalt not worship the devil? Devil worship wrong? Is it wrong to worship Satan?
Yes.
All right. Everybody believes that. But where is the passage which says, thou shalt not worship the devil? I can't find it.
Well, if you can't worship sin. If you worship sin, that's wrong, right?
Why?
God says sin is evil.
Yeah, but there's no passage which says, thou shalt not worship sin, thou shalt not worship the devil.
Well, in the context, then you can't worship the devil.
Okay. You have to get to that point by things like example. Jesus didn't worship the devil, so we've got an example of what's right. And also inference. For example, when God says, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God and him alone, what do you infer from that? Devil worship is wrong. Angel worship is wrong. Worshiping the government is wrong. So you do have statements in the Bible which say, thou shalt not. And those are really clear. But when it comes to drawing authority from example, when it comes to drawing authority from inference, that's where people sort of struggle a little bit. And they say, well, we're just not quite so sure. If there was a thou shalt not, we're good. But if we have to infer something, and that's what we were doing in part with the references that we looked at, 1 Corinthians 16, 1 Corinthians 11, 1 Corinthians 4, Acts chapter 20, we've got an example. Do we follow the example? Is the example binding? Yes, it is. But all too often, people want to, try to get around that. If you probably have done this at some point, or maybe you had this experience, you call for a child. Joe, that's what you do as a parent. Does Joe have an obligation? What's Joe need to do? Joe needs to respond, either holler, yeah, I'm here, or come. But you didn't say, Joe, come. You didn't give a specific command. But Joe does some inferring, doesn't he? Doesn't even the dog draw inference? Now, that may not be what you do for your pet, but but you make that funny noise, or you say the dog's name, or you say a word like walk, or you rattle the biscuit bag, and what's the dog or the kitty do? It is treat time. It's time to eat. It's time to go outside. So even animals can infer. We should have at least the sense of an animal to infer. Or we should have the sense of an animal to learn from examples. But a lot of times when it comes to Christians, they don't. All right, we're going to really switch gears here unless there's something you want to add or ask. Okay. You may have covered this in a class. I doubt it. Anybody here ever hear one cup communion?
Yes.
Okay. Now, if a congregation wants to have one cup communion, do they have that right? Sure. I mean, if they want to have one cup, a million cups, it's up to them. But you have some difficulty when it comes to binding that and saying, unless you have one cup, you're going to go to hell. And there have been some groups which have insisted on that. If you ever come across that, let me encourage you to think about Acts chapter 2. But how many people become Christians on the day of Pentecost? 3,000. How often are they meeting? Okay. Meeting every day. How often are they worshiping? All right. Weekly. Let's take a look at Acts 4:4. Somebody want to read that? I should have identified somebody. We had too many helpers. Who wants to take care of that first? Bonnie, all right.
Howbeit many of them which heard the word believed, and the number of the men was about 5,000.
Okay. So at the time of Acts 4:4, what do we have as far as people?
5,000.
About 5,000
men.
Church is growing quickly. But even in Acts 2, you've got about 3,000 people who become Christians. All right, now I didn't, for the purpose of this class, measure out how much grape juice we partake of on a regular basis. But I think a fair amount is going to be a teaspoon of grape juice. All right. I'm not exactly the most skilled one in the kitchen, but I think we can go ahead and make some quick measurements here. So when we think about that, we're talking about maybe 3,000, or with just the men, 5,000 if they were married, and they've got kids, that would be around 15,000 people, but let's just round that down a little bit. Let's say that we've got about 12,000 people, and each one gets a teaspoon. All right, about how much would that be? Well, if I've got this right, 3 teaspoons are a tablespoon, and we've got 16 tablespoons in a cup, 4 cups in a quart, and we've got 4 quarts in a gallon. And then we would point out that we have, with 5,000 people, we've got 6.5 gallons of grape juice. And then if you begin to do the math that we talked about earlier with husbands and or wives in there, you've got roughly 20 gallons of juice every Sunday. And that's assuming that we're using the teaspoon arrangement. They could have had a little bit more. They could have had a little bit less. All right. Now, that's going to be a little bit difficult for one cuppers, isn't it? Don?
Are you assuming that they're all meeting together?
Well, at least when you look in Acts chapter 2, you've got the 3,000 people who seem to be coming together.
Who were they? I assume that they were being in small groups and homes and stuff like that.
Well, you do have that. As you look at Acts 2:46 a little bit later, you've got a distinction made there. Yeah, I think you're a little ahead of me, Glenda, but you're exactly right. Day by day, continuing steadfastly with one accord in the temple, breaking bread at home. There were some things that they did at home. But remember, the temple complex was about 50 acres. It was a huge, huge area. And until the Jews really became unfriendly with Christians, it seems like the Jews were willing to let them meet there. So it would have been entirely possible for them to meet in that area. That would have been a free place to meet. So you've got about 20 gallons of juice that would have been needed for that number of people. And then you've also got over here, I didn't bring out a different color pen, so we'll just mark out a little section up here. You've also got the time element. I don't know how long it takes you to partake of communion, but let's just say on the average it takes 5 seconds. And if you have all those Christians, 75,000 seconds, 1,250 minutes. Now this is for the one cuppers. Or you've got 20 hours involved for everybody to drink from the same container somehow. Now, I don't think any, and I think, Don, they'd probably try to argue, well, look, you know, there were multiple containers or multiple gatherings, and they try to get out of it. But if you ever deal with that, you probably have somebody's eyes pop out if you ever start doing the math with them. But that is, I think, an easy way to talk about the one-cup arrangement, that here you've got, let's just do the math for 3,000 people, and it makes no sense whatsoever. And yet, that would, in my mind, be one of the things that they would have had to struggle with. How are we going to have 3,000 people drink from one cup? You know, even if you take 300 people, you divide it up into 10 groups in Jerusalem, still that would have been a massive number of people to try to get to drink from one cup. So that may seem like, in some respects, a somewhat silly thing, but it is also very, very important because that has been used to divide congregations in our day and time. And that's unfortunate, but that's the way it's been.
Glad you put that up there because years ago, I attended a Lutheran church 50 years ago, and they changed from once a month to 7 times a year. And the reason for that was because of the cost. Now, in here, we wouldn't see a very big cost if we changed to just once a month. But if you take like a Lutheran church that's got churches all over the country, it'd be the same as if all of the churches of Christ said, okay, we're going to cut that up. How much money would the church save by doing that? And if that's what they gave for changing that.
Yeah, and there have been some groups that have done that. They have said, looked at it from an economic standpoint and said it's going to be a lot less. We can save X number of dollars. But that, again, misses that point that we talked about earlier. It's not, can we save money? Can we make it more convenient? Can we accomplish this, that, or the other thing? What does the Bible say? So you eliminate cost, you eliminate public opinion, whatever it might be. What do the scriptures tell us? But you're exactly right. And they were not the only ones. Glenda?
Yeah, I was